Welcome to the Lighthouse Conversations, a podcast featuring entrepreneurs and tastemakers from the world of arts and culture, tech, and of course, food. I'm your host, Hesham Montasser. My guest today is Maha Ma'moun, an award-winning Egyptian artist and curator. Since 2004, she's been a founding board member of the Contemporary Image Collective. And in 2013, she founded a super interesting publishing platform called Kaifateh. More recently, Maha co-curated the exhibition How to Maneuver Shape-Shifting Texts and Other Publishing Tactics at Warehouse 421 in Abu Dhabi. Maha's work has long fascinated me and has had an impact on me since I first became aware of it in 2016, shortly before we founded The Lighthouse. She uses video and photography to examine and zoom in on particular themes within our mainstream culture. So we'll talk a little bit about her inspirations and how she got to work on those pieces that can invoke a very strong and at times even surprising reaction. More recently, I'm very pleased to announce that The Lighthouse acquired some of Maha's work, which is now permanently on display at our new outpost at Mall of the Emirates next to the Apple Store. And that's where I wanted to kick off our conversation. Well, as a first stop, you know, thank you for your lovely works, which are adorn our walls now at Mall of the Emirates, our new outlet. And I would love for you to come and see it, inshallah, soon when things quiet down.
Yeah.
So we really appreciate that. And it honestly makes me very happy every day when I walk in and I see those beautiful works. So wow. Really a big thank you.
No, thank you. I'm very happy that they have this, that they're there in Lighthouse and they have a big audience. That's something very special.
One of the things you and I discussed when we were starting discussing of possibly bringing some of your work and acquiring it for the Lighthouse was my feeling that I told you, you know, many artists, including yourself, that have been had a high dose of success and have been known and have been put in galleries and have been put in museums and part of larger collections, to maybe the wider public, this tends to be at some point intimidating. And they only see them within those walls, you know, and within a very curated environment. And one of the things I felt very strongly about, that maybe we can shorten that distance a little bit. And by putting, you know, artists in certain spaces, such as the Lighthouse, that really function as a, you know, kind of multifunctional space, if you will, and don't necessarily as art galleries or museums, that this art is then seen by one, a wider public possibly, or a different kind of audience. Secondly, it lets them interact with the work in a different way. How do you feel about this as an artist, as someone that produced this art? How do you feel about that? Because I would imagine the typical trajectory is this art is acquired by, you know, either institutional collectors like galleries and museums and so on and so forth, or, you know, kind of larger collectors are put in their homes. So how do you think about your art and where it should be?
Yani, that trajectory exists, you know, that art is acquired by collectors and by museums and shown in galleries and all of this. But I always felt like I don't like my work to be confined to those spaces. Art is always like part of a bigger conversation, or yani, would be nice that it is. And I feel, yeah, speaking from Bardo my context, yani, from Egypt, and the art galleries that exist, yani, they're very few in number. And for you as an audience, yani, to know about them, yani, it's Bardo. There's a bit
challenge.
It's a challenge. It's a privilege that you get to know of these spaces and go to them, in the sense that it's not, yani, something that's widely known. To go to this gallery or that. So yeah, I always wanted or appreciate when art is more accessible to a wider audience, because I don't have like a very like a niche audience that I want to converse with. It's always like a bigger audience. Hatta even like the subjects that I deal with in my work, they are a conversation with our kind of present contemporary history, but also our past. And these are like wider conversations. So it doesn't make sense to me that the the work in the end is confined to a very niche audience.
Well, the beauty of your work, and frankly, specifically some of the series that we have acquired, Kairoscapes and Domestic Tourism, is anyone can connect to it in an instant in a way, and yet the feeling it gives will be different for different people, if you know what I mean. So there's, I find, an amazing amount of depth, but the initial interaction with the art piece is relatively easy because it's an image that many can relate to, either as someone like myself, as an Egyptian who grew up there, who knows those places, who can very much relate to that image, but it doesn't mean it's going to convey in me the same emotion it will invoke in someone else who may have had a very different experience looking at it. Yet it has that easy connection. And that's what I found fascinating. And I found that if we put it to a larger audience that's not necessarily versed in the arts, so to speak, they would have a connection, but that connection will be different. And that hopefully over time starts a very different conversation. How do you feel when you are, I mean, it is a common thread amongst many of your artworks, I found, and even your videos. So there's this sort of almost, you know, common, you know, everyday images, situations that anyone can see and spot, and yet you twist it. Is that, do you find that this has always been part of your practice and something that's been, you've been attracted to?
I think so, yes. Yeah, when you say twisted, I think what I often do is that if I'm looking at a big narrative, I often go to a certain detail, for example.
Yes.
And by just zooming in on a detail, that already twists the bigger
correct.
Narrative. A twist can be just by choosing a certain fragment and working on that, but it can also be
zooming
that
in.
You add, you, it can be just the zooming in, but it can also be that you do certain further kind of twists. So this project, Domestic Tourism, it first started with a series of photographs, four photographs, two of which are in the lighthouse. A few years later, the film Domestic Tourism 2. So, for example, in the images, the photographic images, I started from generic images of Egypt that are circulated in the touristic kind of industry, like in postcards, advertisements about Egypt. And so you have the felucca floating in a timeless kind of space and time that you cannot really locate. It can be anytime.
Almost surreal.
Yeah. So it's, I think for many of us, when we see like these advertisements of Egypt and like in the tourism kind of, under the tourism kind of umbrella, sometimes we don't recognize those places, right? They are too 100%. exclusive beaches that not everyone can go to. For me, I wanted to take off from that point and present kind of alternative images. And what I was doing is not like photographing reality versus the packaged advertisement. I did not want to do that. So here comes the intervention, the twists that I made in these pictures. So for example, rather than going to the posh exclusive beach advertised, I would go to a public beach that is accessible to everyone. But I don't. The photograph I take there is not just a straight photograph. I insert a certain kind of twist, which is my other feelings that exist in that space that I want to bring to the picture. So for example, the experience of going to a public beach in Egypt, there is discomfort also, right? There is discomfort
100%.
Because of like the kind of density, but also the body in this public space. And all of these things that you, in the touristic image, you find like a couple of tourists having the whole place to themselves and being served whatever they want. But that's not like in that beach, it's not like that. You have like 1,000 people and we're all in close proximity and we are slightly uncomfortable. And so I wanted to bring that in. And
can I interrupt you? What's so interesting about this particular image is it does make you slightly uncomfortable, and yet they look very comfortable. So, you know, funnily enough, you know, or there is a certain, you know, discomfort, I think, because of that twist that you've inserted. And yet it looks like a happy image, if you know what I mean. You know, it depicts a simplicity that in some ways we may not even find or have anymore. And to me, that was almost part of the discomfort, you know, that I do not, that simplicity is not invoked in me, whether an exclusive, more posh beach, as you said, or in a public beach, which I might be uncomfortable for other reasons. But those people in the picture that are depicted seem to react to it very differently. And that brings in, to me at least, all these complexities and the layers that come with Egypt and its, you know, social strata and complexities that come with that as well.
True. I think it's because I did not want to create a dystopia versus the advertisement, you know.
Exactly.
I wanted to just photograph something that exists, like a place where, like you see it with your eyes, but then how you feel it also. And how you feel it is not necessarily something that would be captured by the image. I can do that if I want and like choose an angle and choose a certain thing that can, but I did not want to, I wanted to photograph a place and then insert my own feeling about it or about the general context. And like in this image in particular, the beach, so the twist is like, just it is, like you say, you may not necessarily feel it, but what I did is that I composited the image. So I brought in, I photographed a certain spot over some time, and then I brought in swimmers or people on the beach from different moments in time, but it's in the same location. So then I actually increased the number of people
the density.
Who are in the image. Yeah, but I also, by doing that, you feel there's something strange, like because the woman in the picture is not necessarily, wasn't necessarily next to that other person in the picture at the same time, right? They are coming from different times. So they are not aware of each other necessarily.
Exactly.
And maybe that comes across when you see the image. You feel like there's all these people, but everyone is in their own world.
Exactly. Is they look unencumbered. So they look happy. But the reality of it, which is another further twist, is in fact, they weren't all there at the same time. So maybe part of that feeling is in fact that this lady may have been there at the time when there were only two other swimmers and it wasn't as busy. So I don't know, which is fascinating, right? So it's sort of this multi-layered, some of it is reality and some of it is not. I mean, that was a reality, but that reality may have been very different at the moment you shot that picture.
But also like, and I think these twists, what they do is that it kind of gives you a heightened sense of reality maybe, or that, okay, you use a certain tool or twist in order to bring out something that would not necessarily show if you took a straight picture, right? So like you use a certain, there are certain things that you do to, okay, there's a reality that is not photographable. So then you do a certain little twist and then that reality becomes more apparent. So these are the little twists that I think I try to do is there's something, it's not very visible, but if you make a certain change, it becomes visible in a way that was not possible before.
What made you go back a few years later, which is somewhat unusual, and pick up the same body of work essentially, but now in video form with yet another new twist to it? I mean, I would imagine typically an artist would sort of, you know, finish a body of work and then move on to the next thing. But you went back to revisit it, but now in video form. And I mean, the kind of thread is there, but it's a whole new twist that you've put in the videos. And obviously we're going to put all of this in the show notes so the listeners can watch the videos and look at the images. But walk us through your thought process of going back and deciding to revisit it. What made you do that?
In the domestic tourism photographic series, I did not have like the pyramids or like, so it's the kind of obvious obvious location of tourism that was not, that I did not choose to go to in that series. And that stayed with me that, okay, there is this, the site par excellence that has not been visited in this series. But I was not necessarily intending to work on it later, but then I was just watching a film, an Egyptian film, and there was a scene where you had a couple going, having lamuneta, and they're sitting, and the pyramid is actually kind of sitting in between them. They're like, the backdrop of the pyramid is so present, and but it's just a backdrop. But for me, I felt okay. I mean, it's not just a backdrop. There is something. There is an importance to going to that site, but it's not necessarily very clear in the film. But there is something there that for which the director decided, okay, I'm going to shoot this this shot in front of the pyramids. And this subliminal thing, sometimes it's intentional. There is some, you can read it in the narrative of the film, that there is a, why did they go to the pyramids to do this scene? But sometimes it's not necessarily that intentional, or there's not necessarily a subtext that the director wants to bring in, but it is brought in somehow. So I started to get curious about how the pyramids are represented in cinema. So it's a particular lens, like how the pyramids are represented in the cinematic narrative, because I felt, okay, the touristic kind of narrative is put aside a little bit, or it's not the main focus. There is every film has a different story and a different trajectory and all of that, but I wanted to see how the pyramids are weaved into an Egyptian narrative. These films are meant for an Egyptian audience. They're not meant to advertise Egypt abroad. So then how do the pyramids come in, and what are the meanings? How do the pyramids figure in local Egyptian narratives?
Local culture over decades, right? Because you are really kind of contrasting a multi-decade evolution or devolution or whatever you may want to call it, mm-hmm. of with the backdrop of the pyramids, you know, and the politics of that era and the intended audience of that era. And you see a very visible change over, you know, in each sort of decade.
Right. So when I started getting interested in this subject, I started, of course, researching, like looking, asking friends, like if they remember a film, what films do they remember that have a scene shot in front of the pyramids? And I started, compiling lists of films that I watched, and what becomes clear when you see, like, you see certain genres emerging. So sometimes the pyramids appears in a scene, and it's the subtext is maybe timelessness, eternity, or you have Abdul Halim Hafiz, he's dying young, and he goes on a picnic with his lover, and that's the what they talk about is about health and longevity and dying young, and that's the subtext, but in front of the pyramids as this kind of very long-lived monument. You have other, like, and there are other genres. There's like the genre of going to the pyramids and lamenting, there's like these lamentation scenes, I call them, where you kind of talk about how the present is corrupt and how glorious the past was, for example. It comes in different variations. So there were these different genres, and what these different genres reflect are the different episodes in Egyptian contemporary history, but also in cinematic history, as it moves from, let's say, light comedy to kind of realism and getting more involved in the kind of economic and political traumas of the 80s and 90s towards a different twist. And so there is by looking at these different scenes, you see a change in how the Egyptian history is narrated, or the different episodes in Egyptian history, but you also see a development in cinema, in cinematic history, and how it moved from one kind of language to another. And this was interesting for me. So I just chose the scenes, for those who do not know the film, the film in the end is like a composite of scenes that I've selected from a wide range of films from the 50s up till the 2000s. I think 2005 or 2007 was the last scene I chose. And when you see that, like these scenes together on a timeline, what becomes kind of clear, I hope, is that, okay, you have this constant, the pyramids, but then you have changing symbolisms or changing ways, changing narratives, or you see how the pyramids are used to convey different meanings throughout time.
Yeah. When we come back, we'll talk about Maha and her process and whether 2020 has had an impact on how she thinks about her future work, right after this short break. I wanted to take a minute and tell you about our friends at Monviso, one of our sponsors who make this show possible. Monviso is founded by an Italian entrepreneur right here in Dubai and has evolved into one of the region's most popular mineral waters sourced directly from the Italian Alps. We immediately connected with the Monviso's team vision and how giving back is such an integral part of their mission. Through their extensive recycling program and their Take Water, Give Life initiative, proceeds from every bottle of water sold is donated to Al Jalila Foundation to support its education and research. So stock up on still or mineral water by using our exclusive Monviso discount code, Lighthouse10, which you can redeem at store.monviso.com. Once again, the code is Lighthouse10, Lighthouse10, 10. Welcome back. You're listening to my conversation with award-winning artist and curator, Maha Ma'moun. I think this takes... It holds particular importance at the moment where both in Egypt, but also in the Gulf and at least in the Middle East at large, you have this sort of large, you know, attempt, you know, very, very ambitious attempt to build museums and art institutes and others that are sort of preserving heritage and redisplaying pieces of art and our history and so on. I'm talking about the overall region, because I think that question of what's put in and what's left out has a special resonance when you start thinking about, you know, a new generation that will only see what's obviously on display. And I mean, do you feel as an artist that is sort of almost part of your responsibility is to document both the celebrated and the discarded? Because there's definitely an element of discarded things in a lot of your videos and your work, you know, and almost to the point that it starts veering on the absurd in some cases, you know, where, you know, which I loved. But do you feel that is something that you, you know, want to document and highlight consciously, or is it a subconscious thing?
So in terms of like the building of museums and like these kind of huge venues that deal with the politics of representation and all of this. In Egypt, we don't have that, right? We don't have this move has not necessarily happened in Egypt, where there is like this move to create. There is in a way, but it's
the new Egyptian Museum. I mean, that's what I came to mind, right?
You're right.
Here in the Gulf, you're looking more contemporary, obviously, and you know maybe the heritage is different, but the new Egyptian Museum to me is very much part of that. You know, the current march and all of those displays that you're seeing is very much part of, you know, showcasing, you know, highlighting, emphasizing certain elements. At least that's how I perceived it.
Yeah, that's true. But I can say like in the, for example, domestic tourism too, the film, I wanted to take the pyramids outside a bit of the official kind of overbearing narrative in which the pyramids in one way or another throughout these films is kind of a representation of Egypt and more precisely of Egypt, the nation state, rather than Egypt, the ancient, like, you know, history with all its with all of its different kind of philosophies, science, religions, all of that is taken out of the picture. And for me, if we talk about the new Egyptian Museum, I would say this again, this focus is on nation building, nation
100%.
You know, the nation state, celebrating it, exporting it, you know, all of this. And I'm sure a lot is still left out of the picture. The complexity of this history is taken out of the picture. You want to freeze that history, like take a snapshot of the glorious ancient Egyptian civilization and history and package it and present it, which is great because there's a lot to be seen and learned. But you can, you know that the it's a kind of very particular lens through which this is looked at and presented. In my work, there is this interest in platforms, right? In sharing the work with a larger audience. It's an interest in public space, you can say. And how to expand this space, this public space, and who can be part of it and what can be part of it. And this also, I think, is something that is very integral to this to the publishing project that I am part of. That me and Alaa Younes together, we formed this publishing initiative called Kayfate. And it started in 2012, 2013. And again, our interest in that came from our interest, from our experience as artists and curators, our experience in the exclusivity of certain art spaces and of us, of access to a wider public, right? So we felt, okay, maybe how do we get out of this? We don't want to be in that box. We don't want to be in that box only.
Only, yeah, yeah. No, Akid, you definitely want to be, some extent you need to be in that box. But you want to be able to show a multitude of platforms and dimensions to the kind of work.
Like the box doesn't have to be that small.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be that exclusive. The box
can I just be a bit cynical here for a second? As an artist, I mean, as an artist that ultimately, you know, sells her art, isn't it useful for it to actually be very exclusive? In fact, the more exclusive, you know, the more rarefied, the more sought after it is. So are you, I mean, could one argue cynically, okay, from a commercial standpoint, that you sort of then shoot yourself in the foot in a way because you demystify the you know, that sort of rarefied air that comes with art and artists and artworks by sort of saying, you know what, I'm going to create a platform that's far more accessible. Isn't the whole point of it being exclusive and elite, which is why commercially it, you know, sort of over time increases in value?
True. I think there is an element of shooting oneself in the foot.
Interesting.
I do that all the time.
we all do.
But, you know, like my films, for example, I have them and the films are sold, of course, and that's important for me. But I also have them open access on Vimeo, for example.
Yeah, I noticed that. And I was going to bring this up again. Exactly. So you seem to, and I would like to say that this really shows the kind of confidence you have. You seem to be comfortable in coexisting those two worlds. In other words, feeling that the works speak for themselves, they have their own inherent value. Collectors, buyers, etc., will value them, but it doesn't mean you should try to make them overly exclusive or, you know, just present them to a particular niche audience.
Exactly. I think one can play with these two registers, right? Of the exclusivity or like the rarefied thing about art, but also play the other register too. And this can be in like by making different works, one that is meant to be, to have this aura of exclusivity and then another track that is not that.
100%. How does Kayfate factor into this? Who was the intended audience for this when you and Alaa started launching those series?
So the intended audience was a mixed audience. Also, the intended authors that we would invite to this series were also mixed. So the idea was to get out of, try to get out of this box. Like we as artists encounter a lot of great authors who are sometimes you come across them in the field of art and the expanded programs that happen around art. And we found that, okay, I mean, these authors are not necessarily, you know, unintelligible for others. You know, they're not necessarily that exclusive in their in their language or so we wanted to. And then there are other authors who are have more of exposure in the mainstream and who are not necessarily seen or taken with the same seriousness or they're not viewed in like there's this division between like certain circles that are kept apart, and we felt we'd like to bring a different, like a variety of authors who don't necessarily all inhabit the same circles of production and circulation and all of this, to bring them in the same series, but also by doing that, also bring like a mixed readership to this series. So we commission authors, that's what we do. We kind of, we have a certain sensibility that is not necessarily that outspoken or like that rigid or clear to us, but we do share a sensibility in who you'd like to in, to invite to the series to write something for Kayfate. And once we agree on someone, we start a conversation with that author, and we are very clear in saying we would like to invite you to propose a question, because the Kayfate series is like a how-to series. We would like you to propose a question that you think is important, pertinent to the moment, and we would like you to keep to address a general audience, to keep a general audience in mind. And this sometimes does something, it does change. Sometimes, I don't know to what extent, but sometimes, for example, the reaction to that request of keeping a general audience in mind opens up certain venues or topics that they would not necessarily have gone to. So for example, a writer who is mostly writes political opinion pieces, for example, that are published in print or online newspaper kind of news outlets, chose to write about dreams, about his kind of lucid dream life and how he interprets them or what comes into those dreams and what not. And this is like, I'm referring to How to Remember Your Dreams by Amr Ezzat, that is an Egyptian writer.
Yes.
So that was interesting to see what this, when you put this thing at the forefront that you are addressing a general public, certain things happen. People, like we wanted, part of the things that would happen is that people would start writing, like not use certain kind of, you know, terminology that is exclusive or...
Yeah, I was going to say that. They cannot hide behind the terminologies and the kind of big words that a lot of times you feel sort of, you know, when you start this conversation with a potential author, is this a back and forth, or is this, you know, please write something, send it back to us, we'll edit it and then publish it? I mean, are you using this platform as part of having conversation with those authors, or is it simply you just being a literally a publishing platform to put it out there?
No, there is a conversation for sure. The extent of the conversation or how, the extent of the conversation differs, of course, according to every author.
Depending,
But there is like always in the beginning a back and forth. So we kind of understand we're on the same page regarding the
parameters,
the format, the language, the subject, all of that until we get to that point. Some authors like to keep this going, this back and forth throughout. So we kind of get to see different stages of the work as it develops and we discuss it. And some authors, after we have these initial conversations, then come back with a finished text, which we, of course, again, have questions about or not, a conversation then happens after the finished kind of text for clarifications or things. But conversation is definitely a part of the process. That's why so far we have every monograph that we've published has been something that has developed in conversation somehow. And like we have not been able to, sometimes we get proposals, right?
Mm.
And so far this has not really succeeded with us because
it has only been in conversation, not Hashem sort of calling you and being like, how do you open a restaurant? You know, here you go and boom.
Yeah.
I'm not hinting, by the way. I'm just Has this influenced the rest of your practice? Have you found that some of those conversations are spilling over in some of your other endeavors, whether it's, you know, photography, video, or other kind of, you know, multidisciplinary works that you do, or is that sort of siloed in your mind?
No, it has spilled over, not necessarily. And of course, I'm sure like all of these conversations, they leave something behind beyond the finished book. But the conversation that is being kind of enriched throughout this process is this conversation about publishing as a subject and as a space that is fought over and yeah. This interest in alternative publishing, right? The different ways, like how do you, if you have and this connects to art as well, like if you have a public space that is completely taken over by for-profit publishing houses, and as a result of that, a certain codified kind of genres that are more sellable, or names that are more sellable, or safe, or you know, so there's all of these this codification of and like tightening of access to this public space that happens, and again on the fringes, on the margin of this, is all the other voices that do not have, they write in a different way that is not sellable, their names are a bit either unknown or there are question marks about them. All of these things that are happening on the margin become of interest, and like of how, again, navigating this line separating the what is allowed public space and what is not, what is allowed the exclusive space of the gallery and what is not. So it's always these kind of boundaries that one lingers on, whether in publishing or in the artistic practice. So this is something that is always kind of developing, and I get to learn of as I go through this research, of different kinds of figures that were very interesting in recent history in Egypt that we did not necessarily look at so much. And it's and also especially like the when kind of there is a kind of interconnection between art and publishing.
And there's an irony, right? Because in a way there are restrictions and censorship and all of that, of course. On another way, an explosion of platforms, you know, so offline, online. So you would have thought that with the kind of proliferation of platforms, there'll be much more of an enriched dialogue, and yet that is being clamped down even more. How do you feel as a kind of more multidisciplinary artist, which is fascinating? I mean, you know, a while back, I had one of my conversations on a podcast with a gallerist here in Dubai, and we were talking about Hassan Sharif. And, you know, as part of Hassan's practice, I mean, he was also publishing and writing and part of a number of groups, as you well know. And he also was a cartoonist for a number of years for a local newspaper, and then completely gave up being cartoonist. And, you know, and people sometimes are surprised when they see this, because they see him as this very sort of conceptual artist, as very avant-garde. And those things don't necessarily, they go hand in hand in many ways. So clearly, when I look at the body of your work, you're very multidisciplinary in terms of the type of output you have. Let's put it this way. When you are working on in a particular art form, let's say you're looking at publishing right now, Is that all you can do, or are you able to produce in sort of various different types, moduses at the same time, mediums at the same time?
I do get kind of swallowed up by by whatever, like the certain.
So you go deep.
Yeah, so publishing has been taking a lot of my time, but then I do things also in parallel. So, for example, in the past few months, I've been working on an image for an album cover for an Egyptian musician and composer, Maurice Lua. So his new album is coming out as both vinyl and CD.
Wow, it's called, that's great.
Hour.
Vinyl and CD.
He's an amazing musician, and I've been working with Maurice across different albums of his. But this is something that I find interesting. For example, so how we work together on developing the concept and then the final image for this album, and this is, for example, one thing I've been doing parallel to the publishing thing, and now I'm developing a new work that is still the form is not clear yet, and this is something that is maybe what kind of makes this multi-form or multi-discipline thing happen is that I do not start knowing that this
what final form it will take. Do you start with the subject?
Exactly. I try to delay that decision as much as possible, which is difficult. It kind of makes things more difficult.
Where do you start? What's the starting point? Is it the subject matter?
Yes, I start. I think I start with a subject matter, and then I research. I have this kind of. I don't know how to call it, but this curse or this blessing of spending lots of time researching.
Sure.
And
blessing for sure.
At some point, I'm either exhausted by this research or something crystallizes, and I say, okay, I'm going to focus on this and that, and this and that. They lend themselves to film, or they lend themselves to photographs, or to a publication. So this is how it happened. And like for Dear Animal, for example, this film, it was preceded by a long kind of research into the subject I started with was, why is there suddenly, or what I feel was suddenly, an increased interest in animals, right? Why are animals appearing so often now in talk shows, in newspaper kind of opinion pieces, in paintings, in film, and in Facebook posts. And I felt this appearance, this kind of increased use of animals and across these different medias has, there is something to it. Something is trying to appear, or people are trying to say something through this form of the animal. And after this kind of long, extensive research, there came a point where, okay, I chose only two of these things that I came across, like a short story by Haysam Lwardani and a series of Facebook posts by Azza Shaaben. And I brought them together in a film.
I mean, the film is brilliant. I mean, and the sort of, I mean, this is the part that, to me, I mean, there's this mischievous element that you bring in. And I think it's brilliant because you sort of watch it and every time you think, you know, you won't go there, you actually do. So I found it, I don't want to أحرق عليهم, they say, I don't want to burn the film for those that are going to watch it. But I was watching it saying, no, she's not going to go there. And then you do. I'm like, oh my God, she did go there. So I have to say.
So curious now to know what those things were that you thought, oh, I wouldn't go there. And then
There was a couple of them. I let the audience watch for themselves. And again, you know, that's, I think, the beauty of art, right? Everybody has a different reaction and maybe something that didn't occur to you or may have. But I've learned to appreciate over the years that you experience it the way you do. And that's okay. And there's no right or wrong. But I very much enjoyed watching it, I have to say. just in terms of what's coming in the maybe in the future. So you are again starting from kind of a subject matter, and then beyond working with your fellow musician, and then you kind of wait and see what form it eventually takes. Have you felt that the last, let's say, 2 years now, pandemic and all of that, has that in any way shaped your thinking in terms of medium and what you want to put out there in the future, or no?
I'm sure it does. So for me, like, okay, what this kind of lockdown has encouraged me to do is that it gave me more time. And I love that. I love to have like time without deadlines, and then I can just wander off following different kind of threads that lead nowhere. So it was kind of an invitation to do that. And I'm sure this will lead somewhere, or it kind of opened up certain things that I would have never watched or would have never had the time to read. So it kind of opened these threads. The online presence thing, of course, I mean, one is kind of in, like the most I was invited to throughout that year was, of course, like, you know, Zoom presentations or discussions or online reading groups and things like that. So I do feel like for KFT, for example, we started realizing the importance of being available online, which is something we are working on. There has been less exhibitions, of course, or almost none. So that kind of wheel of production has halted a little bit, which again, I welcome. Because yeah, I felt like the world was going too fast and we need to maybe slow down our process a little bit. So that came in, like was welcomed. But yeah, I think it kind of just opened up more space to reflect on what one has done, or to indulge in open-ended research. But it has not yet made me feel like, oh, my next project is necessarily something that can be shared online. Not necessarily. Okay. In the end, like I said,
it hasn't
like
restricted research, your way of thinking about future production.
Not necessarily. It hasn't restricted it. It may be added a new venue that is worth thinking about. But it's like, if I work this long process of research, in the end, the form that comes to mind, the best form that comes to mind for this research is a sculpture, then it will be a sculpture. Okay, but enough. Then there is the online thing that may be something else. There's a different format that can be presented online or whatever. But yeah. Mm-hmm. Long answer.
No, absolutely. It's fascinating because, I mean, I think part of what you're saying also is that it could manifest itself differently, you know, in it could have different manifestations of the same art matter, art piece, which is so interesting, right? It doesn't need to be in one form only. Two people could experience it differently. One could experience it in physical form, you know, as a, let's go with your idea, as a sculpture. And then Hashim could be sitting somewhere else where he has no access to it and experience it in a very different form. I think that's very interesting, as opposed to necessarily just trying to do a rendition of whatever is physical or vice versa, right? Well, Maha, it's been a pleasure. Thank you again. And honestly, thank you for making the time, for sharing with us all your views. I know that a lot of artists are sometimes reluctant to have these conversations, especially with laymen like myself, and sort of dissect further. So I really appreciate that you went in and you know, had patience for all my ruminations and misinterpretations possibly. But I think that also speaks about the work and the quality of the work you do, the effect it has, honestly, not just on me and many others, and inshallah, a lot more to come.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed this conversation and honored by the invitation. And all of your questions were spot on. They touched on like some of the main questions, you know, that one that I visit in my work. Thank you so much.
Thank you, man. All the best. Thank you. Thank you for joining the Lighthouse Conversations with me, Hashim Montasser. We're produced by Chirag Desai and our content director is Farha Sharif. If you're joining us for the first time, you can follow the show on any of your podcast apps like Apple, Spotify, Google Podcast, or Anghami. You can also connect with us on Instagram at @thelighthouse_AE. We'll see you again in 2 weeks.